Tomorrow morning, the concluding Bunyan study will be, I think, the adult class, and I can only say don't miss it because it is so climactic and challenging. It's both a blessing and very sobering, too. I can warn you of that. So two aspects there you'll soon see when we get to this. Now we come to page 142, and we have now the encounter of Christian and Hopeful with another pilgrim whose name is called Byens. Now I saw in my dream that Christian did not press on alone, for another pilgrim named Hopeful joined with him and by means of a brotherly covenant agreed to be his companion. He was persuaded to take this course because of the witness of Christian and Faithful, and especially their suffering at Vanity Fair. Thus one died to make a testimony for the truth, and another arose from his ashes to become a companion for Christian. This Hopeful also told Christian that there were many more men at the fair who would after a while follow him. And so Bunyan stresses very much the importance of fellowship in pilgrimage. We are going to meet a character in the near future called Little Faith, and one of his problems is he's traveling solo. It's not good to travel solo as a Christian. The Bible really knows nothing of that. Rather, we travel in a convoy. We call it church fellowship. And Hopeful is provided as a substitute for Faithful. But now we move on. So I noticed that soon after they had departed from the fair, they overtook another pilgrim ahead of them whose name was Byens. Byens. Again, I think you can sense straight away this is, again, an apostate. He is not a legitimate pilgrim, really. The meaning is that he is a man who will use any means by which he'll obtain a selfish end. We'll see this even, he gives a wonderful illustration about a pastor is self-serving. We'll get to that in a moment. Top there on right-hand column of page 142. Christian, you say you come from Fair Speech. Do any good and commendable people live there? Yes, I hope so. Further down. Then, if I may be bold, do tell me who some of these friends are. To be honest, almost the whole town, and a particular, my Lord Turnabout, my Lord Time Server, my Lord Fair Speech, from whose ancestors the town first took its name. Also there was Mr. Smoothman, Mr. Facing Both Ways, Mr. Anything, and the pastor of our parish, Mr. Two Tongues. Says one thing out this side of his mouth and another thing out the other side of his mouth. Mr. Two Tongues, who was my mother's own brother on my father's side? You try and work that out. That's Mr. Two Tongues, you see. Who was my mother's own brother on my father's side? And to tell you the truth, I have become a gentleman of high quality, though my great-grandfather was merely an oarsman for hire who would look one way and row another. I obtained most of my possessions by means of the same occupation. Are you married, a married man? Yes, and my wife is a very virtuous woman. She is my Lady Feignings, or my Lady Pretender's daughter, and therefore she came from a very honourable family. As a result, she has reached a high level of breeding. Her deportment is always impeccable before either princes or peasants. It is true that our religion differs to some degree when compared with the more strict variety, but only in two small portions or points. First, we never strive against the wind and the tide. Second, we are always very zealous in following a religion that parades in silver slippers. We love to walk with such sumptuous company, that is, when the sun shines and people applaud. That's telling you where this man's spiritual breeding comes from. All right. Christian, sir, you talk as if you knew more than the whole world, and if I am not mistaken, with only half a guess, you are easily identified. Is not your name Mr. Byens of Fair Speech? That is not my name, though it is a nickname that has been attributed to me by those who cannot suffer me. But I must be content to endure this reproach. just as other good men have done when similarly maligned. Well, I'm going to shorten this chapter by just summarizing. What happens is eventually Mr. Byans wants to walk with Hopeful and with Christian. And they say, no, you can't walk with us, because if you walk with us, you don't just walk in silver slippers, you walk in times again of poverty and want, you know, and so forth. And eventually they part. And so Byans is trundling on behind them. And then we read that suddenly three of his old school chums catch up with him. So you have Byans and his three school chums. Go to page 146. And the right-hand column at the top, the name of these men, these three school chums, were Mr. Hold the World, Mr. Money Love, and Mr. Save All. Now, what happens is between that particular group of four, they begin to talk, and Byans explains that his friends ahead of him, Christian and Hopeful, were rather, you know, exclusive, and they said that we could only walk with them if they walked in times of trouble as well as in times of blessing and so forth, you know. And so this group of four then debate among themselves about what they consider to be the foolishness of the understanding of Hopeful and Christian as they travel. And they then bring up various situations. For instance, turn over page 148. Mr. Moneylove, halfway down the right-hand column there. I understand the substance of your question, and with ready permission of these gentlemen, I will attempt to provide an answer. First, let us focus on the instance of the minister of religion. Supposing a pastor, a reputable man, in charge of a parish that provides a very small benefice or financial support, yet has his eyes set on a more prestigious and materially prosperous pastoral opportunity. And supposing his prospects of gaining this advancement are improved if he becomes more studious, if he preaches more frequently and earnestly, and if he adjusts some of his principles to suit the temper of this large congregation. Then for my part, I see no reason why a man ought not to pursue this course, provided he receives a call. I mean, the morality here. Really, however, is that which I think Bunyan is reporting concerning what he's seen in the pastorates around him and ministers and how they pursue big churches and bigger stipends and all that sort of thing. That's, you see, what Byans and his friends are all about. Very mercenary, you see. And let's turn over the page to 150. Left-hand column, halfway down. Suppose such a person in his business has low profitability, but by becoming religious, he may upgrade his opportunities for increased revenue, such as by marrying a rich wife or something similar. And as a result, far more customers come to his shop. For my part, I see no reason why this course may not be pursued. See, in other words, you've got a company of fools here, and they're convincing one another of their ungodliness. That's what's happening, you see. Over the page. And what happens is then Byans and his three friends get so convinced of their arguments, they say, let's catch up with Hopeful and Christian again. Let's overtake them and talk them and talk about the foolishness of the way they are so exclusively walking on their own, you know? And so they catch up. And let's go over the page again here. No, I'm sorry. Back on page 150. And they catch up with Hopeful and Christian, and they begin to make their point that, you know, there's nothing wrong with our rationale for using money and self-advancement, even if it involves, you know, religion and that sort of thing. Perfectly right and proper. Now, Christian then responds. He slays them. Look on the right-hand column there on page 150. Christian, even a babe in religion, could answer 10,000 questions of this type. For according to John 6, it is certainly unlawful to follow Christ for bread. Then how much more abominable it is to turn he and religion into a stalking horse. for the purpose of obtaining and enjoying the world. The only ones who are of this opinion are the heathen, hypocrites, devils, and witches. And so then he expands upon this. You'll notice the heathen, hypocrites, such as the Pharisees, Judas, Simon the sorcerer. And so he is arguing here the sheer worldliness, the godlessness of their whole worldview. Look at the right-hand column there regarding Judas. Neither does it escape my mind that a man who will take up religion to profit from the world will also throw away that same religion to suit the world. In the same way Judas became religious because of his worldly designs, then he was willing to sell his religion and his master for the same reason. Therefore, to answer the question positively, as I perceive that you have done in heathenish, hypocritical, and devil, and is that you have done is heathenish, hypocritical, and devilish, and your reward will be according to your works. Then they stood staring at one another without knowing what to say in reply to Christian, hopeful, fully approved of the soundness of Christian's answer, so that there was a great silence among them. Mr. Byans and his companions staggered in the face of such a response and purposely lagged behind so the Christian hopeful might easily get ahead of them. But this again is where, although now Byans and his three friends are behind, Christian hopeful are now pressing on ahead, all right? But the next scene again raises the question, I wonder what's going to happen to Byans and his friends when they come to the silver mine at the hill Lucca. It's a perfect setup here because they will be tested at this situation. Look in page 154. Then Christian hopeful moved ahead of Byans and his friends once again. So they travelled until they came to a delicate plain called Ease, across which they journeyed with much satisfaction, though this plain was also narrow so that they quickly passed through it. Now at the other side of this plain was a small hill called Lucca, greedy prophet, and within it a silver mine. And because of the rarity of this place, some pilgrims have gone this way, had turned aside to investigate it. Down to paragraph C. Then I saw in my dream that a little off the side of the road and right next to the silver mine stood Demas, standing like a gentleman. He would invite passing pilgrims to step aside and investigate the site. So he hailed Christian and his companion. Hello there, friends. Come over here and I will show you something quite remarkable. Christian, what would be so deserving our attention as to draw us out of the way? Demas, here is a silver mine, and right now some are digging in it for treasure. If you also would come here with only a little effort, you will be able to richly enhance yourselves. Now notice in this situation how it is that hopeful becomes a little weak and Christian is the strong one. You'll see in a while why that's important. Hopeful says, if this is true, then let us go and investigate. Christian says, no, not I. I have previously heard of the reputation of this place and how many have been destroyed there. And besides this, the treasure being promised is in fact a snare for those who seek it because it hinders them in their pilgrimage. Then Christian called to Demas asking, is this not a dangerous place and has it not hindered many others in their pilgrimage? It is not very dangerous, except to those who are careless. Nevertheless, he blushed as he spoke this way. So Christian to hopeful, let us not wander aside even one step, but instead keep on our way. Over the page. I've also put a note here that the silver mine is a subsidiary enterprise of Vanity Fair. Think about that. 156, at the top there, Christian says, speaking bluntly, Demas, you are an enemy of those who pursue the right paths of the Lord of this way. Of course, obviously, you remember Demas. Paul writes about him. Demas has forsaken me, having loved this present world. I know that you yourself have been rebuked because of your own turning aside here, and that by one of his majesty's judges. So, why do you seek to bring us into the same condemnation? Besides, If we were to turn aside here, our Lord the King would certainly hear about this and reveal our shame, whereas our desire is to stand before him with boldness. In reply, Demas only pleaded further. He professed to be one of their kinsmen and proposed that if they would only wait a short while, he would then join them on pilgrimage. Christian, what is your name? Is it not the same as I've already called you? Yes, my name is Demas. I am the son of Abraham. I know you. Gehazi was your great-grandfather, and Judas was your father. And you have continued to walk in their ways. What you are now suggesting is simply one of your commonly used devilish tricks. Your father was hanged as a traitor, and you also deserve no better reward. Do be assured that when we have audience with the king, we will tell him of your treacherous behavior. So Christian hopeful continued on their way, though they remained in sight of Bions and his friends. Now again, you see, this is what's the inevitable response of Bions and his friends when they come to the silver mine? You can guess, of course. They remained in sight of Bions and his friends, ahead of them, that is. And it was noticed when the trailing party arrived at the silver mine, they immediately left the way in response to the invitation of Demas. Now, whether they fell down the mine shaft by looking over the edge, or whether they went down to dig, or whether they were smothered at the bottom of the damps or poisonous fumes there that often arise in those depths, I am not certain. But this I did observe, that they were never seen again in the way. So Christians sang. It's interesting in Pilgrim's Progress, the number of occasions you see the pilgrims singing. They often sing at the end of an incident. It indicates, of course, Bunyan's great love for singing. And he writes hymns. And that was rather novel in his time. Bions and Silver, Demas, both agree. One calls, the other runs, that he may be a sharer in his lucre. So these two take up in this world and no further go. Over the page. They travel on now and they come to the monument to Lot's wife. She who was petrified when she looked back and had longing to go back to Sodom and Gomorrah. Now I saw that just on the other side of this plain, the pilgrims came to a place where an old monument stood right next to the highway. At the sight of this, they were both concerned because of the strangeness of its shape, for it seemed to them as if it had been a woman and who was transformed into a pillar. Therefore, they stood intently looking at it. But for a time, they did not know what to conclude. Eventually, Hopeful noticed an inscription on the head, though in an unusual style of writing. So being no scholar, he called upon Christian on account of his learning to see if he could interpret the meaning. So after some study of the letters, he found the meaning of this, "Remember Lot's wife." Further down, "Ah, my brother," said Christian, "this is a timely sight, for it has come just at the right time after the invitation which Demas gave us to step aside from the way and view the hill Lucca. And had we gone over as he desired and as you were inclined to do," this is Christian sort of, you know, reminding his fellow, "you wanted to go there, I didn't, you see. And had we gone over as he desired and as you were inclined to do, my brother, I suppose it is quite likely that we ourselves would have become a similar spectacle for those who will follow after us." Hopeful, "I am sorry that I was so foolish. And the thought of this makes me wonder why I am not now as petrified as Lot's wife. For in what way was there a difference between her sin and mine? She only looked back, whereas I had a desire to investigate the mine. Let grace be adored here, and let me be ashamed that such a thought should ever enter my heart." Notice here again where Christian is sort of gently saying, you know, "you are the weak one. I warned you not to go down there, and I was right and you were wrong." Well, I want to warn you here that in an incident coming up very soon, we'll see the roles reversed, where Christian becomes the weak and foolish one, and Hopeful becomes the stronger and wiser one. Let's move on over the page there. Oh, now at the bottom there of 158, sorry. "But above all, I ponder one particular thing, and that is how Demas and his friends can so confidently stand over there looking for treasure while this woman merely looked behind her. For we do not read that she stepped so much as one step out of the way. Nevertheless, she turned into a pillar of salt, and the judgment which overtook her remains an example and within sight of those rummaging in the mine. For if they were to simply lift up their eyes, they could not miss seeing her. Then over the page, we won't deal any more with this, except to point out, you get further discussion here between Christian and Hopeful, and the argument, the discussion is over the fact that Lot's wife, she looked and she was petrified and was lost. Hopeful says that, yeah, I know that, and look at me. I had a longing to go to the silver mine. You warned me, and I was saved. And there's sort of discussion about the distinction between Lot's wife and the weakness of Hopeful. And Hopeful, of course, is saying it's only the grace of God. But nevertheless, he is delivered and Lot's wife was lost. And that's what they discussed there. Over the page, another major incident in the Pilgrim's Progress. Christian and Hopeful are captured by giant despair. Great section, this. Then I saw that they went on their way and reached a pleasant river, which King David called the River of God, but John the Apostle, the River of the Water of Life. Now their way went directly alongside the bank of the river. Therefore here Christian and Hopeful walk with great delight. They also drank of the water of the river, which they found to be invigorating to their weary spirits. Furthermore, on either side, the banks of this river had green trees that bore every variety of fruit, and the leaves of trees had good medicinal value. Now they were particularly delighted with the fruit of these trees, and they also ate the leaves to prevent gluttony and other diseases related to hot-bloodedness in their travels. Again, Bunyan deals here particularly with depression among pilgrims. But also pilgrims can become weary, even weary and well-doing. Christians can relapse into carnality, even be backward-looking rather than forward-looking. And so the strength of the pilgrims here is meant, I think, to heighten the fact that they're about to fall and show real weakness as they travel along here. Over the page, page 164. Now I beheld in my dream that they had not journeyed very far ahead when the river and the way divided and began to go in separate directions. For this reason they were displeased, though at the same time they were also fearful of leaving the straight path. However, as they went on, they continued to wish for an easier way. And now that the straight path was heading away from the river, it also became more rough and troublesome, while at the same time their feet were becoming more tender on account of their travels. So the souls of the pilgrim became increasingly discouraged on account of the harshness of the way. Of course, you've got parallel here with the moaning and groaning of Israel in the wilderness. You've also got, a parallel with the fact that Christian was faced with three ways when he was confronted with the hill difficulty. You remember that? And formalist hypocrisy, one to the left, one to the right, and they were lost, and he went up the hill. Now, here's the case where the way gets rough and difficult, and they complain about it, and they get in trouble on that account. Not a little ahead of them was on the left-hand side of the road a meadow, and the stile giving access to it over a fence. And that meadow was called Bypath Meadow. Then Christian said to his companion, "If this meadow runs alongside of our way, then let us cross over to it." So he went to the stile to investigate, and behold, a pathway on the other side of the fence seemed to run parallel with their way. "This is exactly as I had hoped for," said Christian. "Here the going is much easier. So come, my good Hopeful, and let us cross over." Now who's the one who's leading this going astray? Christian. He's the one who was strongest when they came to the hill, the mine there at the hill Lucca. So you know the way it's reversed here, you know. And Christian really puts his foot in it here. We read on. "Hopeful, but what if this new path should lead us out of the way?" "That is not likely. Look, does it not run alongside our way except on the other side of the fence?" So Hopeful, being persuaded by Christian, followed him over the stile. Notice, I put in a note here, how easy and rational is this transition from the straight to the crooked path. How fatal are the consequences, how difficult it is to return. Read on. Now, when they had gone over and began to travel along this new path, they found it much easier on their feet. Moreover, on looking ahead of them, they caught sight of a man walking in the same direction. So they called out to him and asked him where this way led. He then replied, to the celestial gate. He's a liar. Look, said Christian, did I not tell you so? With this advice, you can be sure that we are going in the right direction. So they followed, and vain confidence went ahead of them. Again, they're not taking heed to the warning of evangelists who had warned them about such trials and such deceit. Page 166, but behold, the night began to overtake them so that it grew very dark. As a result, they who were behind lost sight of he who was ahead. Therefore, he that was ahead of them, being vain confidence by name, because he could not see the way ahead of them, fell into a deep pit. Right-hand column, little way down. And now it began to rain and thunder and lightning, and in a fearful manner, so that rising water began to flood the path. Then Hopeful inwardly groaned while declaring, if only I had kept in the way I was going. Christian, who could have thought that this wood path would lead us out of the way? Then further down, good brother, do not be offended. I am ever so sorry that I have led you out of the way and exposed you to such impending danger. I earnestly ask you to forgive me. I did not act out of evil intent. No, but he just acted out of disobedience, that's all. Hopeful, be comforted, my brother, for I forgive you. I also believe that this seeming tragedy shall work out for our good. It does, ultimately, yeah. So I am glad, says Christian, that I have such a merciful brother traveling with me. But let us not stand here any longer. We must try to return to the right way. In that case, my good brother, let me lead the way. No, if you please, let me go first. Then if we encounter any danger, I can deal with it, since I am responsible for our getting out of the way. No, you shall not go first, because your mind is troubled, and for this reason you may lead us out of the way once again. Then for their encouragement, they heard the voice of one saying, let your heart be set toward the highway, even the way that you formerly went along. Go back there. But by this time the flood waters had risen much higher and made the way much more dangerous. Then I understood that it is easier going out of the way when we are there than going into the way, than when we are out. Still, they made every good effort to go back, but it was so dark and the floodwaters had risen so high that in such an attempt they could have easily been drowned 9 or 10 times. Over the page. Neither were they, with all of their skill and determination, able to return to the stile that night. Therefore, having at last found refuge in a small shelter, they sat down there awaiting daybreak. But being weary, they soon fell asleep. Now, again, I want to stress, this is an adult incident which is going to deal with the adult problem of depression. And how Christians get into it here, ultimately, of course, it's because of they are wandering out of the way, the straight way, and they get into a dark setting and they are depressed eventually, and they're going to even think about committing suicide. But this is an adult situation. And in all of this, this is what I want to raise with you as a question. In this situation for a Christian, what is the answer to this darkness and depression? Read on here. Neither were they with all this yet. Now, not far from this place where they slept, there was a castle called Doubting Castle. Doubt itself becomes often an indication of despair, a part of the whole process. The owner of it being Giant Despair, and they were lying asleep in his territory. Therefore, having arisen early in the morning while walking up and down in his fields, this giant caught Christian and Hopeful asleep in his realm. Then with a grim and surly tone to his voice, he ordered them to awaken and tell them where they were from and what they were doing on his property. They replied that they were pilgrims who had lost their way. Then said the giant, you have trespassed against me by trampling upon and lying on my grounds. Therefore you must come with me, So they were forced to go with the giant because he was stronger than they. And as they went along, they had very little to say because they knew that this circumstance was their own fault. Therefore, the giant drove them in front of him and eventually secured them in his castle by locking them in a very dark dungeon that was so foul and stinking to the spirits of the two prisoners. Here then they lay. Now, this is an important point. I'm not going to reveal everything here, but you must remember this. Notice this. Here they lay from Wednesday morning until Saturday night. Keep that in mind. Without receiving one bit of bread, one drop of drink, any light whatsoever, or even someone to ask how they were. Therefore, they found themselves in an evil situation while being far from friends and acquaintances. So in this place, Christian sorrow was multiplied because it was on account of his hasty advice that they had been brought into this distressing state of affairs. Now, notice here, do they make any recourse to means of grace, to the word of God, to all prayer? No. When people get depressed, when they go into this form of darkness, you'll find they're not so interested in prayer or reading the Bible. But read on. Here then they lay from Wednesday morning until Saturday night without receiving. I read that. All right, further down. Now, Giant Despair had a wife and her name was Diffidence. On the right-hand page, we've got a footnote there. Diffidence means shyness, reticence, the lack of assertiveness, mediated to the pilgrims so that they fail to seek mercy and relief from their Lord. She imports to them these weaknesses of shyness, reticence, lack of assertiveness in seeking the mercy and asking God to deliver them, you see. They don't do that. They take on these attributes which the giant's wife communicates. So when he went to bed that evening, he told his wife what he had done. That is, how he had taken a couple of prisoners and incarcerated them for trespassing on his grounds. Then he sought her advice as to what he ought to do with them the following day. So she inquired as to who they were, where they had come from, and where they were going, and he told her. Then she advised him that when he arose in the morning, he should beat them without the slightest mercy. Further down, then the giant lay into them with his cudgel most fiercely, so beating them that they were unable to protect themselves or even move on the floor. This done, he left them there to commiserate in their great distress and mourn over their calamity. The next night, Diffidence further talked with her husband about the prisoners, and on learning that they were still alive, she advised him to recommend to them that they commit suicide. Further down, the giant then told them that since they would never be released from their bondage, they could only take the alternative way of escape, which for them was to commit suicide using either a knife, a noose, or poison. Again, notice here. Now, on the right-hand page, I've put this. On Thursday, Diffidence recommends a beating. On Friday, Diffidence recommends committing suicide. You know, things are getting grim during the week there, aren't they? Over the page. Top of page 170. But the prisoners asked that he let them go, at which the giant scowled as if he was about to rush at them. Undoubtedly, he would have finished them off then and there, except that he fell into a fit, for sometimes in sunny weather these seizures overtook him. When the light comes, Giant Despair has a fit and is paralyzed. Think about that. Therefore, he withdrew from the dungeon and left the captives to consider what they ought to do. Further down, Christian says, my brother, what shall we do? The life that we now live is miserable. For my part, I do not know whether it is best for us to live as we are or to die at our own hand. My soul chooses strangling rather than life. And the grave appears more desirable than this dungeon. Shall we accept the giant's advice? Now, on the right-hand page there, I've summarize the advice that Hopeful give. Hopeful becomes the strong one in this situation. It's Christian who is especially despairing. At the top, you've got what Hopeful presents, and that is the case against suicide. One, suicide is prohibited by their Lord. Two, suicide kills the body and the soul. Three, suicide does not offer ease beyond the grave. And furthermore, says Hopeful, there are alternatives to suicide. the escape from despair, the death of despair, the paralysis of despair, the resistance of despair, the endurance of despair. Bunyan writes elsewhere that only those in hell should despair, otherwise mercy is still on offer to the biggest sinners. Over the page, 172. At this, the prisoners greatly trembled with terror, and I think Christian fell into a swoon, but reviving himself a little, they renewed their conversation about the giant's advice and whether it might now be best to take it or not. Now, Christian again seemed more inclined to heed this counsel, but Hopeful made his second reply as follows. Okay. My brother, remember how valiant you have been up to this point in our journey. Apollyon could not crush you, nor for that matter could all that you heard and saw and felt in the valley of the shadow of death. What hardship, terror, and confusion you have already experienced. So do all of these count for nothing in your present fearful plight? You understand that I am imprisoned with you, a far weaker man by nature than ever you were. Further, this giant has wounded me as well as yourself, and he has deprived me of bread and water, even as you. And along with you, I detest this darkness. But still, let us exercise a little more patience. Remember, how you played the man at Vanity Fair, and were not afraid of the shackles or cage or even bloody death? Therefore, at least, to avoid the shame that a Christian ought not to be associated with, let us bear up with patience as well as we can. And here you see again his Hopeful being so true to his name. Now, further down, so when the morning had come, the giant went to the prisoners once again and took them into this castle yard. We showed them the remains just as his wife had directed him. These, he said, were once pilgrims as you now are. They also trespassed in my grounds as you have done. So when I thought fit, I tore them in pieces, and within 10 days, I will do the same to you. Now go, return to your dungeon once again. And with that, he beat them all the way back to their cell. And there they lay all day Saturday in a most miserable condition just as before. Now look at the right-hand page at the bottom. I've got a footnote here. Here the pilgrims represent the child of God's descent into depression. Do Christians get depressed? They do. Yeah. The cause can be spiritual or it can be physical too. That's another matter. Here the pilgrims represent the child of God's descent into depression. Great saints have not been excluded here. Consider David, Paul, Luther, Spurgeon, Cowper, who even attempted suicide. And then he writes, and I quote to you from Cowper, "Where is that blessedness I knew when first I saw the Lord? Where is that soul-refreshing view of Jesus and his word? Return, O holy dove, return, sweet messenger of rest. I hate the sin that made thee mourn and drove me from thy breast." Christians get depressed. Great Christians get depressed. And we have to face that reality. The question is then how we address it. And I will give you the clue here that the paralysis of despair is the shining of light upon the soul. Think on that. The paralysis of despair comes with the shining of light in the soul. The pilgrims have been incarcerated. It's dark. They haven't turned to the word. They haven't turned to prayer. Now look on page 174 at the top there. Well, on Saturday about midnight, let me ask you something. It's a very simple question. What day follows after Saturday midnight? Sunday. Ah! In a good church, what is Sunday to be the day for? Surely for remembrance of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, remembrance of the gospel, remembrance of the word of God, being enlightened with the truth of the promises of God. Now, in the light of that, you can see what Bunyan's doing. Look at this here. Well, on Saturday about midnight, the prisoners began to pray. First time they've been praying since they've been here. And they continued in prayer until almost the break of day. Now, a short while before it was daylight, Christian, like someone suddenly amazed, broke out with a most passionate exclamation. What a fool I have been to lie here like this in a stinking dungeon when I could have just as well walked free. In my chest pocket I have a key called promise that will, I am thoroughly persuaded, open any lock in Doubting Castle. Then said Hopeful, that is good news, my brother. That's gospel, if you like, the promises of God. My good brother, do immediately take it out of your pocket and try it. Again, on the Lord's Day, it's the day when the promises of God are preached to us and we think on them and we're encouraged by them. Then Christian took the key from his chest and began to try the lock of the dungeon door, and as he turned the key and the bolt unlocked, then the door flew open with ease, so the Christian Hopeful immediately came out. Then he went to the outer door that leads to the castle yard, and with his key his door was also opened. After that he went to the outer iron gate, for that needed to be unlocked as well. Now this lock was damnably hard. Some people have said, oh, Mr. Bunyan, that's a little strong language. Some have said that John Bunyan here is sort of, you know, going back to his godless days, you know, slipping with his language. Not at all. Not at all. What does the word damnation mean? It means basically consignment to hell. And what is this prison doing? It's doing exactly that. And when they come to this final gate to try and unlock this gate which confines them, it resists the promises of God. Hell resists the promises of God. It's damnably hard to open. But you read here. This is not a misplaced use of a raw word here. Yet the key did eventually open it. So they thrust open the gate, made their escape with great speed. But as it opened, that particular gate made such a creaking sound that it awakened Giant Despair, who hurriedly arising to pursue his prisoners, suddenly felt a paralysis come over his limbs. For his seizures came on him once again, so that it was impossible for him to chase after the escapees. Now, do you see the principle? Deliverance from despair and darkness. Its paralysis comes with the shining of the light of the truth of God. That's what he's saying here. Because the giant pursues them and then he has a fit. Why? Because he goes out in the daylight and the light shines it and he has this disease. He has a fit. He's paralyzed by the light. Despair is paralyzed by light. Despair is paralyzed by truth. Promises of God, they've suddenly grasped them. They're rushing away from the confinement of this terrible condition. This is an adult book, friends. Now, when they had returned over the stile, they began to consider. Oh, no, go back a bit, sorry. Then Christian Hopeful went on till they came to the king's highway once again, and here they were safe because they were out of the giant's jurisdiction. Light brings the paralysis of despair. At the bottom I've put there on page 175, in this whole scene, Grunion draws upon his own checkered experience that is so honestly described in his spiritual autobiography. You'll read in Grace Abounding, even when Christian is, when he's converted, later on that you'll see some points of despair, and sometimes he's wondering whether he's saved almost. I remember many years ago when I was in London, England, I was working and I felt the call to the ministry. I didn't stay there too much longer. I was married, my wife and I there, and then we came back to Australia. But I remember one night anyway, I was working and I simply lost interest in the work. Advertising, I was in that, I'd studied it for years and so forth. Anyway, in London I had this job involved with that, but I just had no taste for it. I wanted to preach the word, wanted to go into the ministry. Anyway, one Sunday night, just because I had to go to work the next day, you know, ever had that Sunday night feeling? Oh, work tomorrow. You ever had that feeling? I know. I know exactly what it's like. Anyway, that night I got on the underground in London and I went to St. James Underground Station, got up there, you go, a street called Petit France, go up to a church called Westminster Chapel where Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones was preaching that night. I heard him a number of times. And anyway, I'm walking up Petit France there and I'm going to church and I'm thinking, oh, tomorrow. I don't want to go to work tomorrow, you know. I was depressed about it, you know. I went to the church there and heard Dr. Lloyd-Jones preach. What a message. What a revival took place in my soul that night and lifted me out of that earlier feeling. I remember coming out of the church and I came back down Petty France Lane there and went to the St. James Underground Station. But I remember thinking, I walked out of that church and I was walking down there and this was my thoughts. I thought, you know, it doesn't matter what happens tomorrow. I'm right with God. I'm at peace with God. And I'll never forget that message he gave. I can't tell you the text, but all I know is he so elevated me as a Christian to know what I was in God's sight, that I was safe and all was well. I walked down that street. I still had to go to work tomorrow. My attitude changed. See? This is what happens here exactly, precisely what happened. In darkness, in despair, neglecting the word, no prayer, and then suddenly light shines with the promises of God, and light brings about the paralysis of despair. That's what you've got here. Isn't that up to date? Anyone despairing this morning in this way? I'll tell you, you will be lifted up when you know you're a child of God and nothing can separate you from the love of God which is in Christ Jesus. Over the page. They reached the Delectable Mountains. They were promised that there would be these pastoral hills and they would meet some shepherds there. 176. Then they went forward until they came to the Delectable Mountains, which belonged to the Lord of that hill about which we have spoken before. Thus they drew nearer to the mountains so as to look more closely at the gardens, the orchards, the vineyards, and the fountains of water, where they also drank and washed themselves and freely ate of the fruit of the vine. Now on the tops of these mountains there were shepherds feeding their flocks. On the right-hand page there, notice at the bottom there, you've got them listed here, the shepherd knowledge, the shepherd experience, the shepherd watchful, the shepherd sincere. Of course, again, all embodied in Bunyan himself. Bunyan himself actually wasn't totally perfect. I've told you, Pastor, the story about how he had a very unfortunate encounter with a young lady called Agnes Beaumont. He was going to a meeting west of Bedford. He stopped at a farmhouse there, a friend of his, and there was a young lady there who was a sister of the man who owned this particular farm. And she was there. She wanted to go to John Bunyan's meeting. And she asked whether she could ride on John Bunyan's horse. He said, no, no, no. She asked again, can I ride on your... No, no, no. She asked again. She pressed him. He says, oh, well, all right. So she hops on the back of John Bunyan's horse and off she goes with him off to the meeting. Well, it's unfortunate because as they rode off, her father in a nearby farmhouse saw them riding off. He didn't like the ministry of John Bunyan. So they went to the meeting, and when she came back separately, and when Agnes came home to her father's house, she knocked at the door. He wouldn't let her in. He said, you can only come in if you totally forsake the ministry of John Bunyan and never go to hear him again. So she went across the fields to her brother's house and stayed the night there. Eventually, she was persuaded to go back to her father and say, all right, I won't again have anything more to do with John Bunyan. About two or three days later, her father suddenly had some disease come upon him or attack. He died. But there was in the area there a suitor, one who had been pursuing Agnes to try and have her as his wife, and she had, I think, spurned him. And anyway, there was a rumour started that there had been some hanky-panky between John Bunyan and Agnes Beaumont, and they had poisoned Agnes's father. Well, anyway, there was an autopsy, and of course they found he hadn't been poisoned at all. It was all cleared up, and Agnes married, and she wrote about this. She was a Christian lady, and she wrote about this. I think, however, John Bunyan, if you asked him today and said, John, do you think you would now take Agnes on the back of your horse? I think he would say, never, 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 you know. And all pastors can get caught in these situations, and that's the way it is. Anyway, at these mountains here, which, again, they all represent the pastoral ministry of Bunyan, if you like, here, and the pilgrims are taken to a number of hills. Look on page 179, a hill called Error. This is all under pastoral oversight. Notice that here, you see. And the hill called Error, I'm on page 179 here, At the top it says, here is another representation of the biblical local church, except that unlike the Palace Beautiful, the emphasis here is upon the vital importance of a faithful plurality of eldership and especially their warning ministry. There's four of them, you see. Well, at the hill called Error, there's a dangerous side, and they look down it, both hopeful and look down the bottom, they can see some pilgrims dashed to pieces. And then they ask about them, and they're told that these are the remains of the error of Hymenaeus and Philetus, denying the resurrection, etc. They're taken to another mountain called Caution, and they look down again in the valley there, and they see these men stumbling around. They're blind, but they're like the walking dead. And then a terrifying interpretation is given by the shepherds. They say, see those men there? They're blind, walking around down there. Well, actually, those are men who were waylaid and they were caught by the giant in Doubting Castle there. And down there, there they are, their eyes put out. They're ever delivered over to this existence they have down there and will never escape. Well, when Christian the Hopeful see this, they don't say a word. But they are terribly moved because they think, why did we not end up down in that hopeless situation, you see? In the page then, on page 181, there's a byway to hell. Actually, we saw one really, didn't we, in the Valley of the Shadow of Death. Here's a byway to hell. As a hillside door is opened, and again there's torment and sulfuric fumes and brimstone all coming out, and they're explained, there's explanation given to Christian Hopeful of pilgrims who have gone this way. There's Esau, he went down into this shortcut to hell. Judas, he went there. Alexander the blasphemer, Ananias and Sapphira, they all were taken down into this shortcut to hell. And so they're given these very sobering lessons, you see. Over the page, let's go there on page 182. Little way down, then the shepherds said to one another, let us show the pilgrims here a view of the gates of the celestial city, provided they have the skill to look through our perspective glass. That is a telescope. So the pilgrims gratefully accepted the invitation, except that they were led to the top of a high hill called Clear, and given the shepherd's telescope to look through. Then they attempted to look ahead, but the remembrance of the previous sight that the shepherds had shown them made their hands to shake. With this impediment, they could not look steadily through the telescope, yet they thought they saw something like the gate and some of the glory of the place. This is an amusing but sobering picture here of the pilgrims. They've been affected. They've just seen a shortcut to hell, you know, and they've seen those others wandering around blindly down in the courtyard there of the giant's whole enclave and his castle grounds, and that's shaken them up, you know, terribly. Then they're told, now, take the telescope, you know, and you can see ahead the glory to come. And when they hold the telescope, their hands sort of trembling with fear of what they've just seen, you know. And we can see something of the glory, but it's sort of very much affected by the trembling of the previous scenes. And then we have a parting exhortation. Look on the page 183 there. The shepherds each provide distinctive encouragement for the pilgrims as they press on. Knowledge provides a map of the way ahead. Experience warns of the flatterer ahead. Watchful cautions against sleeping on the enchanted ground. Sincere praise that God will give them speedy and safety on their journey. It's interesting, just a technical point. Look on page 182, paragraph F on the right there. And that paragraph ends. So I awoke from my dream. A lot of speculation about this. So I, Bunyan, awoke from my dream. Then you go over the page and you take it up on page 184. It says, and I slept and dreamed again. And of course, the speculation is, what's he mean by this? And I think one possibility is that got thus far and then he was set free for a short while. He got out of prison for a while. Then he went back into prison, you see. I think that's probably what's going on here. Christian hopeful encounter is first encounter with ignorance. Actually, they'll have three encounters with ignorance. So he's an important character. This is just the first, and it's purely introductory, and this is where we'll conclude for tonight here. But then we have here, and I slept and dreamed again and saw the same two pilgrims going down the mountains along the highway toward the celestial city. Now a little below these mountains on the left-hand side lies the country of conceit. And from it originates a little crooked lane along which pilgrims walk, since it enters into the straight way. Therefore here they met a very brisk lad, a lively young man named Ignorance. So Christian asked him, "From where have you come and where are you going?" "Sir, I was born in the country that lies on our left-hand side, and I'm going to the celestial city. But how do you imagine that you shall gain entrance at the gate? Will you not encounter some difficulty?" "Just as other good people have gained entrance there, so will I. But what acceptable qualification can you show at the gate so that it will be open for you to enter?" "I know my Lord's will, and I have lived a good life. I have repaid every man to whom I was in debt. I frequently pray, I fast, I pay tithes and give alms to the poor, and have forsaken the land of my birth so that I might arrive as a pilgrim." "But you did not enter in at the wicket gate." You see, there it is again. There's what authenticates a true pilgrim, being brought through that gate by Christ. "Rather, you came in here by means of that crooked lane, and therefore I fear, whatever you may think about yourself, that when the day of final reckoning comes, you will be accused of being a thief and a robber instead of qualifying as a legitimate entry for the city. Gentlemen, you are utter strangers to me. I do not know you, so be content to follow your religion, and I'll be content to follow mine. I do hope that all be well, and as for the gate that you talk about, all the world knows that it is a great distance away from our country." It's inconvenient to go in through the wicket gate, you see. "I cannot imagine that any man in our regions knows anything about the way to it. Furthermore, there is no need for them to be concerned about it, since we have, as you can plainly see, a fine, pleasant green lane that leads from our country down into the way right here." Now, he's a religious pilgrim. He is another latitudinarian like Mr. Worldly Wiseman. Over the page. And then Hopeful and Christian talk about him. 186 at the bottom there. Hopeful: "I do not think that it is wise to tell him everything at once. Rather, if you agree, let us leave him for a while and then talk to him later. That is, when he is better prepared to receive it." Right-hand page there in the application. Ignorance will prove to be cultured, biblically and doctrinally knowledgeable, zealous in Christian involvement, persevering to the end, yet appropriately a name, for he is ignorant of the one true gospel. Ignorance is not ignorance of Scripture. It's his ignorance of the gospel. And so they separate from him. Over the page, we have the terrifying end of Turn Away, that short incident. Then we come to Little Faith, and that's a longer section. And we'll conclude tomorrow morning at the adult class. Don't miss it. We'll take it up at page 188. Thank you, Pastor.